had the opportunity for the CTB members to just introduce themselves. Like maybe start with our CTB members, if they just, Dixon, maybe starting with you? Or?
I'm Dixon Whitworth, represent the Stanton District.
I'm Hollis Ellis, urban at large.
Gary Garzinski, Northern Virginia District.
Aubrey Lane with the Hampton Roads District.
Carol Mathis, Assistant Secretary with the CTB.
I'm Sean Connaughton, the Secretary of Transportation, Chairman of the CTB.
I'm Greg Worley, Commissioner of VDOT.
Thelma Drake, Director, Department of Rail and Public Transportation.
Mark Peake is the Lynchburg District. Alan Lauterbach, Rural at Large.
I'm Chef Miller from Norfolk, and I'm an urban at large.
Before we come to the CTB, I want to introduce some of the VDOT key personnel here, starting with you, Mr. Kilpatrick.
Good morning, I'm Charlie Kilpatrick. I'm Chief Deputy Commissioner of VDOT.
I'm
Mary
Wilshire, Chief of
Planning
and Permitting.
Yeah.
Peter
Moore, Chief Engineer.
Brenda Young, Chief of Administration.
My name is Rick Walsh, I'm Chief of Policy.
Mr. Otterback, you can introduce yourself. That's you're kind of a key person down here.
This is me here.
Well, it's here from VDOT. Wayne, where are you? Come on, don't be shy. VDOT DRPT. Again, I'd like to welcome all the members on the Bay Commission. I'd like to maybe just turn to Aubrey Lane, who's not only a member of the CTB, but also the chair of the commission. And Aubrey?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Secretary. We are happy to be here today having this joint session. And just like we've had the Commonwealth Transportation Board members, we'll introduce ourselves, starting over here with Tommy.
I'm Thomas Meehan. I'm a representative of the News District.
Wayne Coleman, Norfolk District.
Jennifer Lee, Portsmouth.
Fred Stant, Virginia Beach.
Wiley, why don't you just come up and come down this
Wiley
way.
Wiley Mitchell, I'm a counsel to the commission.
Bob Johnson, Director of Maintenance for Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel.
Betty Burgess, Executive Secretary and Assistant to the Commission, Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel.
Jeff Allen, Executive Director, and again, we thank everyone for making this possible. Glad to have you here today.
Tom Anderson, Director of Finance and Deputy Director for the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel.
And as you may tell, I serve as the Commonwealth Transportation Board's representative on the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. Thank you very much for having us at the meeting, and we look forward to working together over the next day or so.
Great. Aubrey, thank you, and again, welcome everyone, and we'll get right into our presentations, the Bridge and Tunnel Safety Inspection Program. We have Cora Napier and Jeff Holland.
Good morning. I'm Claude Napier. I'm the Assistant State Structure and Bridge Engineer for the Virginia DOT. What I'd like to do is provide you an overview of VDOT's bridge safety inspection programs. VDOT has 104 personnel dedicated to the structure inspection program. We also inspect approximately 21,000 bridges and culverts. In addition to that, we inspect approximately over 31,000 ancillary structures, which includes sign structures, signal structures, luminaires, high-mast light poles, and camera structures. We do inspect four major tunnels in the state, and what's not included in this list is the downtown tunnel and the midtown tunnel that's done by the Elizabeth River Crossing PPTA, which they inspect and also will operate these facilities, as well as the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. VDOT conducts more than 10,000 bridge and culvert inspections annually. This table shows a breakdown of the number of structures in the state by district. There are approximately 21,000 structures that we inspect, which include both our non-NBI and NBI structures. NBI structures are those structures that meet the definition of federal definition for the National Bridge inventory, and these structures are greater than 21 in length, and they include both bridges and culverts that meet that definition. Our non-NBI structures are those bridges and culverts that are less than 20 feet in length, and also culverts that are greater than 36 square feet in openings, and this includes box culverts that are greater than 6x6. VDOT is required to submit annually to the Federal Highway Administration all NBI bridges that meet their requirements. We do not have to submit the non-NBI structures to the Federal Highway Administration. This breakdown, you can see, is by district, and Stanton District has the largest number of structures in the state with approximately 3,500, followed by the Bristol District in a close second, and Salem District third, for a total of the 21,000 structures, approximately. This table shows the breakdown of the ancillary structures in the state by district, and you can see from this that we have over 31,000 structures, and it includes the sign structures, the luminaires, the signal structures, as well as the high mast light structures and camel pole structures. The Northern Virginia District has approximately 41% of the ancillary structures that we have in the state, followed by the Hampton Road District, which has over 27%, and the Richmond District, which has basically a little over 14% of the ancillary structures. These three districts make up over 82.5% of the inventory of the ancillary structures that we have in the state. This table shows a comparison of the National Bridge Inspection Standards requirements for inspection of structures and VDOT's requirements. You can see that for the National Bridge Inspection Standards for the bridges, the culverts, the fracture critical structures, the fatigue prone details on the steel structures, these are required nationally to have a 2-year inspection frequency. VDOT inspects their bridges that on a 2-year frequency, but based on the risk of this associated with structures, that we also inspect our structurally deficient, our posted structures, and our fractional critical structures on a 1-year frequency. For our culverts, we do inspect the NBI culverts on a 2-year frequency, but our culverts that are non-NBI and that are in good condition, we inspect on a 4-year frequency. For underwater inspection, the national requirement is 5 years, and underwater inspection basically requires that you use divers to inspect the substructure elements of the bridges. Now, VDOT inspects on a 5-year frequency, same as the national requirements. For our sign structures, our signal structures, our high-mast light poles, our camera poles, and our luminaires, there is no national requirement from the Federal Highway Administration to inspect these structures. Up until last year, VDOT was inspecting these structures on a 5-year frequency, but based on a condition assessment and quality assurance review done last year, the department has changed its program of inspection for these structures, where on our critical structures that are high risk, like our cantilever structures, we inspect on a 4-year frequency, and for the lower risk structures we inspect on a 6-year frequency for both the sign structures, the signal structures, and the high mast light poles. For our camera poles and luminaires, we inspect them on a 10-year frequency. And just for your information, since there's no national requirement for ancillary structures, a survey was done nationally last year for all the states plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, and only 71% of the states inspect their sign structures. 56% of these inspect their high mast light poles, and only 40% of the states inspect their signal structures, and it drops down to 17% for the luminaires and 13% for the camera pole structures. This next table shows the breakdown by district of the inspections that were conducted by the state from July 2012 through June 2013. You can see that basically each of the districts are inspecting approximately 50% of their structures. And last year we inspected a total of basically 10,775 structures. This slide shows the organization for the districts and the central office that handles the bridge safety inspection program. Our district offices are responsible for the inventory, inspection, and load rating of all the structures in their districts. There are 94 dedicated bridge safety inspection personnel assigned to the districts. This includes a dedicated bridge safety inspection engineer in each district, as well as dedicated bridge safety inspection teams to perform inspections. There is a designated load rating engineer in each district, and this person is required to be a professional engineer. This person normally also has other duties that he performs in the districts. We have professional engineers, our National Bridge Inspection Standards certified engineers, and technicians that perform inspections. In the central office, the section that I oversee is responsible for the policy, procedure, quality assurance, and the inventory database management. I have 10 structure and bridge personnel dedicated to the bridge safety inspection program, and this includes 3 dedicated people that work with the DMV that perform load ratings for all the overload permits. We have 10 consultant contracts statewide. One of these is an underwater inspection consultant contract to perform underwater inspections, and the other 9 are either district or regional consultant inspection contracts for bridges and ancillary structures. This slide really shows you the inspection criteria that we look at, and our bridge safety inspectors are trained to determine the general condition rating of our structures. This general condition rating is rated from 0 to 9, with 0 being a failed condition and 9 being an excellent condition. You can see that on this chart that goes across there, any structure that's rated less than a general condition rating of 5 is structurally deficient. Last year, for fiscal year 13,
just a clarification, is imminent failure and fail? I mean, when do we close a bridge?
We close, I mean, each district bridge engineer and bridge safety inspection engineer, based upon the condition that they assess and they perform a load rating, they make a determination to close the bridge. And basically, we're looking at when structures get down to a general condition rating 3 is basically when we can actually perform additional load rating on that structure and make a determination of whether it should be remain open to traffic.
But we, for instance, we wouldn't have a 1 or a 0, or obviously, or, you know, open, a rating of 1 or...
We do not have any structures in the state that have a 1 or 0 rating.
Okay, thank you.
If they do, any structure that drops below that 3 is generally closed.
Thank you.
Sir? Yes, Ms. Mill.
So you're telling us that if it's below a 3, it's closed. Is that sort of policy, or...
No, that's not really policy. That is a determination that is made by the district bridge engineers based upon a load rating of that structure to determine the safe load carrying capacity. And if the load carrying capacity is less than 3 tons, then that structure is closed.
So it's not a subjective measure, it's an objective measure.
That's correct, sir.
That would, and if the, you know, we look at this data all the time and we look at stuff that's structurally deficient or that has some other nomenclature, Mr. Chairman, which I can't recall sometimes, and it, to the public, it means something different than it means to y'all as engineers and who deal with it. That always leaves me a little bit uneasy because we look at stuff and say it's, we use some words that to the layman would say, that's not good. And while it's not good, it's not near as bad as they think it may be.
That's true, sir, but I mean, that's a national criteria when we talk about structurally deficient. That's actually defined by the Federal Highway Administration as well as the criteria for functionally obsolescence.
Yeah, and that's the other, I think that's also what Mr. Miller is talking about, is the functional.
Well, and we call some stuff structurally deficient, and we drive on it.
Oh, absolutely, sir.
All day long, every day.
Yes, sir.
Now,
anything that has
in the lobby, he said, the engineer from VDOT and the Federal Highway Administration said this bridge is structurally deficient. Would you like to drive on it? The normal answer would be not no, but loudly no. Okay, so it sends the message. It is different than what it ought to be said. I mean, I know we can't change their nomenclature, but I mean, I think Mr. Lane and I both asked this question early some years back. We saw a lot of our bridges were structurally deficient, and that doesn't mean the same thing as a layman might interpret. And that's why I brought it up. But so you're telling us that basically, if it gets to 3, it's going to be load tested.
No, load rated. Actually, when the condition rating drops down to a 4 or a 3, then that actual condition warrants a load rating because you can actually determine a reduction in load carrying capacity of
the
structure.
Right, so if it was rated for 6,000 pounds, we might determine it can only carry 3,000 pounds and say anybody over 3,000 pounds can't go over it.
Well, I mean, if it's 3,000 pounds, it's closed. Three tons or less, then the bridge is closed. The only structures that we have in the state that are less than 3 tons on Tangier Island, where they use the golf cart.
The number is irrelevant to me. All I'm saying is that we might reduce the load limit on a bridge given its condition.
Absolutely, sir. That's correct.
That's what I'm getting at. Thank you.
Last year, for fiscal year 13, we spent approximately a little over $26 million on the inspection program, inspecting basically 10,775 bridges. This really comes out to about approximately a little over $2,400 per bridge. And then we also spent $4.6 million on the inspection of ancillary structures, for inspecting a little over 3,000 structures last year, which comes out to about $1,500 for ancillary structures. Now, this really is, if you look at the bridge, is basically VDOT inspectors inspect about 80% of the bridges at about 20% of the cost. Our consultants inspect bridges at about 20% of the number of bridges at 80% of the cost. And on the ancillary structures, the majority of all of those are inspected by consultants. And the price for those is really, considering that it is being done by consultant inspections for the higher cost for the ancillary structures and the requirements for the maintenance of traffic, as well as all of these structures being in urban locations and the non-destructive testing that we do on the anchor bases for our critical structures. Well, the quality assurance program is VDOT conducts an annual quality assurance program of all nine district bridge safety inspection programs each year. And actually VDOT started this program in the early 90s. The Federal Highway Administration conducts an annual National Bridge Inspection Standards compliance review of each state each year, and they review the statewide inventory database, organization, inspection procedures, and so forth like that based upon the National Bridge Inspection Standards. They also perform a quality assurance review of at least one or two districts in the state each year. VDOT is in compliance with the Federal Highway Administration's review. In summary, VDOT has over 21,000, approximately 21,000 bridges and culverts to inspect, over 31,000 ancillary structures to inspect, and VDOT has trained safety inspection personnel that are required to pass the National Highway Institute Safety Inspection of In-Surface Bridge Training Course. They are also required to take a bridge refresher training course once every 3 years, and then we also have them trained on fracture critical inspection techniques for steel bridges. VDOT exceeds the National Bridge Inspection Standards requirements, and VDOT is in compliance with the Federal Highway Administration 23 metrics that we evaluated on each year. Any questions?
Questions, Secretary?
Yeah, Ms. Gorzinski.
I'd like to know, is there a national database on bridge failures? And my reference is a type of bridge. For instance, the Minneapolis-St. Paul failure, the recent past.
That was August 1st, 2007.
Right. If something like that happens, and we have bridges that are similar design, same design, is there access to the cause of that failure that you have to promulgate the inspections that we might have on a similar bridge in the Commonwealth?
That was a deck truss failure, and after that failure, the department had, I think, basically about 14 deck trusses. And the department went out and inspected each of those deck trusses. After that, we also had over 400 what we call fracture critical structures at the time, and they were all the records were reviewed at the time after that collapse to take it into consideration, as well as about 10% field review of those structures.
So, but you have access to something in another state that has failed that you can then...
Usually that comes out, and now the FHWA is providing us some information on that, as well as, you know, the social media, not the social right. media, but the Internet. You can log on and obtain information on any of these type failures, like the I-5 failure that just occurred in the state of Washington, which was a through thrust.
Thank you.
Secretary.
Yes, Mr. Whitmore.
A couple of questions. Can you give us the breakdown of the percentage of our 20,000 bridges that are below the rank of 5?
Basically, the department has a goal that our structurally deficient bridges is less than 8%, and we are currently meeting that goal of less than 8% structurally deficient.
And is there a relationship, I'm sure there is, but is there a guidance relationship between age of a bridge and at what point then it falls below 5?
I don't think that is a very good correlation to that. It really depends on the maintenance practices of the agencies that own the structures. It's like a car. If you maintain a car in good condition, you can get service out of it for an extended period of time. It's the same thing with bridges. But the thing you have to look at is that we have an aging population of structures. The average age of the structures in Virginia are over 40 years old. And also we have an aging interstate, too, where the interstate celebrated its 50-year anniversary a few years ago. So.
And finally, I realize that your comment that we meet the national standards, how does that stand with regard to our sister states? Do we better the national standards in our review and of bridges, or how do we stand with regard to the way other states do their reviews?
FHWA really posted, I think, last year as a requirement on the compliance, and Virginia was found in full compliance with all 23 NBI metrics, and a lot of states did not meet that requirement.
Thanks.
Mr. Lane, then Mr. Ellis? Oh, sorry, was that Mr.
Ellis? Okay.
Yeah, it'll come back.
Yeah, good morning. As far as the sign structures are concerned, I know we had a few issues with those a couple of years ago. Where are we standing with that? Because I noticed in the presentation
we had two failures last year, one in the Richmond District and one in the Northern Virginia District. They were cantilever sign structures, and at that time, the department took a full-scale review of our bridge safety inspection program for our ancillary structures. We actually went out and inspected all of the cantilever sign structures that we had. We did a quality assurance on those and identified deficiencies, and we have been addressing those deficiencies. We also did a statistical sampling for 90% confidence on our cantilever signal structures, and we performed that. Based upon the report that we generated, we have revised our inspection procedures, and we also making significant changes in other program areas pertaining to that.
Okay, so we've always had the 4 to 6 year requirement. It's always been in place. That's not something that we
actually knew. When it was started in the mid-90s, it was a 5-year frequency. And based upon the quality assurance and condition assessment and the risk assessment and also evaluation of what other states were doing, it's the way we came up with the 4-year, the 6-year, and also the 10-year criteria for inspection.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Lana, back to Mr. Lane.
Sorry. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Napier. It's really a very informative presentation. Going back to your chart dealing with the critical evaluations of structures, if what would take a bridge, for example, from a 4 to a 3? Would it be side rails being bad or deteriorating, which would cause, you know, for possible car going over, or would it only be related to weight of the bridge? Weight load of the bridge?
It's based on the criteria for general condition ratings. And we evaluate both the deck, the superstructure, and the substructure components of a bridge, and we also evaluate the culverts. And this is the general condition rating. And when you drop down to a 4, It's basically based on the deterioration of the structure. And if you have a four, you could have, say, significant deterioration if it's a reinforced concrete structure, where you can have corrosion going on the rebars, and you can have spalling, you can have section loss on the reinforcing steel. If it drops down to a three, it means that you've got some significant corrosion going on with these reinforced concrete structures, and that you can actually determine a reduction in the load carrying capacity when you do load rate it.
Following on that, then, if you determine something is having the deterioration at level four, that is something that can be, well, correct me if I'm wrong, but is that something that can be corrected while traffic is still moving on it? In other words, can it be reinforced without closing the bridge or the structure?
That really depends on the deterioration and stuff that you're looking at, and whether it's the superstructure elements and all, and whether it requires the type of rehabilitation that it would require.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Lane?
If I did my math right, it looks like we have about 2,500 bridges in the state that would be, you said, 8% of their total structurally deficient. Are there any which you consider significant bridgeways? I mean, in other words, tunnels, half another one. I'm just trying to get a feel for, you know, what's the most, what we're most least rated, I guess, and they're significant.
Now, you said tunnels, and
well, I guess not included.
We don't load okay. rate tunnels.
All right, so let's go back to bridges then. Okay.
Okay. On the bridges, it's basically we maintain the list of the posted structures that we have throughout the state. These are also on the list for considerations for either rehab or replacement of those structures. So.
Okay, so they move up the list in terms of...
Absolutely, okay. Sir.
Gotcha. Thank you.
Mr. Miller?
I don't want to argue with my CPA friend, but 8% of 20,000 is about 1,600, I think.
Well, I thought it was 31,000.
I agree with that. In any case, whatever it is.
31,000.
You said that we won't get to a 2 or a 1 or a 0, zero without closing it. Zero closing itself. So they're either in a 3 or a 4, those structurally deficient bridges.
Yes, sir.
Either 3s or 4s.
Yes, sir.
And they're, whatever the number is, Mr. Lane, whether it's 1,500 or 2,000, whatever.
Yes. And we have a program that when we inspect it, it's called... critical recommendations, and then when we receive a critical recommendation on a structure, the districts take immediate action on that structure to actually, they evaluate it. That action could be reducing the load carrying capacity of the structure until they can actually do a retrofit of that structure.
And when we fix a structure that's structurally deficient, does that, when we fix it, whatever that means, does that mean by definition it's a 9 when we're done, or could it be a 6 or a 7 or
a... It depends on the element you're fixing, sir. If you replace a structurally deficient deck that is a 4 or a 3 and you replace it, you could have still a superstructure.
A lot of issues that you didn't fix.
Yes.
If you fixed everything,
then you would bring it back up and you'd evaluate it. But, I mean, say if you replace the whole superstructure, yes, you could go back up to a 9 or 8 based upon the criteria.
My question is, whatever the number is that are structurally deficient, and I understand that's not a static number, you know, new ones come on tomorrow and the next day.
Yes, sir. All those structures that we have setting at 5s,
they're going to go to a 4.
They can drop down to a 4.
So of all the 3s and 4s, whether that's 1,500 or 2,500, are all of them programmed in the next 6 years to be above a 4?
No, sir.
What percent are?
I do not know that percentage. I mean, basically, based upon the available funding that we have, is the districts and also the Assistant State Structure and Bridge Engineer for Maintenance sets up the program area. And they prioritize their structures as far as which ones need to be on that 6-year plan.
Well, it would seem to me that Mr. Chairman, as we look at our plans each year, that we ought to continue to, I know we have other needs, and I know that structurally deficient, as we've been educated again this morning, doesn't necessarily mean what a layman would think, but I would think we'd want to keep a pretty close eye on that. I know occasionally we close bridges, never to be built again. We've done that in the Shuckatuck area. I know it was sort of controversial a few years back, and I've been over some bridges in the back countries of Virginia that if they fail, the return on investment would be extremely low to fix it, although if you lived at the other side, it'd be really important to you. But, you know, we've got limited funds, and that's what we did in Essex and Suffolk. So, but I would want to keep an eye on that so that we're allocating money. Maintenance is first. So what does it mean when we don't allocate enough money to take a bridge from structurally deficient to fair in terms of our maintenance is first policy? I'm not looking for your answer on that, sir. I'm just making a general comment. The other thing that I wanted to ask you, which is more of something intriguing, if you go back to slide 4, it was curious to me, and I just wanted to understand it. In looking at the three large districts in terms of population and so forth, Richmond, Hampton Roads, and Northern Virginia, Richmond has 2,000 luminaires, and Hampton Roads and Northern Virginia have 3.5 times that. Northern Virginia has 4,300 signal structures, and Hampton Roads has 400 signal structures. And then you look at camera poles, and we have 284 in Hampton Roads, and there's a smattering around the rest of the state. What does that mean? Well, why is that? Is that the nature of a different, is that a different?
I don't know.
Yeah, it's like cedars down here.
The answer to this question before has been, in Northern Virginia, the localities are Fairfax County, Prince William County, and Loudoun County, all of which are state roads. There's Arlington County, which has their own roads, but we maintain most of the primaries. When you come down to Hampton Roads, the built-up areas are largely cities, which maintain their own roads and their signals and so forth.
So it's basic.
Yeah, it's
correlation to lane miles.
It's
under control.
Yeah. Yes, sir.
Same thing with cameras? Or did we just do cameras in Hampton Roads and we haven't done them a lot of other places yet?
I think it's a different answer for that. There's just dark spaces in the state that we are having our plan to fill in. I don't think it's a matter of whether it's within the.
So you're suggesting that perhaps if we looked at it, and I know you can't really say this with veracity, but if we looked at it and included all cities and counties roads together, no matter who maintained them, it might be a lot closer than what
I would. Yeah, and that's typical when we look at, because there's so many cities and Hampton Roads, that's the normal length.
Sorry, your last slide.
Last, just, sir?
Yeah, number 10. I'm just intrigued about your language there. It says VDOT has. So are we the custodian for the national bridge inventory? Are we the custodian for all bridges? Whether
yes, sir. This number here is. It's our localities, our municipalities, all included in that, and actually they have their own safety inspection program, but FHWA actually holds the state responsible for them meeting the National Bridge Inspection Standards too. So we have to really coordinate with them and work with them to ensure that they comply with the National Bridge Inspection Standards.
So, under federal law, you all keep the inventory and maintain it, even if it's in the city, or so the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel is in this inventory?
The bridge is, the tunnel is not.
Okay. The private bridges, are they in this?
No, sir. National standards do not apply to private structures.
So, like the Jordan Bridge is not in this inventory?
It is not.
And I know the railroads have lots of bridges that actually are on, I mean, on one side of the bridge is a VDOT road, the other side of the bridge is a VDOT road. If it's a railroad bridge, it's not in this?
It's considered a private structure, but the department made the decision in the 90s or even before then, is that we actually inspect all the railroad-owned bridges that carry highway traffic.
Interesting. Yeah, Mr.
Paul, you just generated something else. If we determine a bridge is going to be shut down, do we automatically tear it down, or we just close it?
Well, it's closed until you decide, whoever the owner makes the decision. I mean,
the Kings Highway Bridge, we closed it.
Yes.
And then it was subsequently tore down. Mm-hmm. Did we tear it down?
No, the Kings Highway.
Or did, I mean,
is that owned by the city? If it's owned by the city, then they would have the contract to do the demolition.
So we wouldn't do it unless it was, the owner would then make the decision to tear it down.
That's correct, sir. The owner would make
it. We would just close it. And then okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chairman.
Commissioner Member? Oh, yeah, Ms. Longenthal.
One follow-up question, Mr. Napier. The bridges that we have, I'm sure they all fall within those nine categories. Again, going back to that chart, and I don't know how many are in each category, but do we have existing policy that kind of watch it? I know we're watching them, but I mean that we're now trying to get ahead of the curve, so to speak, because it's kind of like the old commercial with the guy holding up the dirty oil filter and saying, pay me now or pay me later. And I know part of this has been due to lack of funds or maybe in the past, not strong emphasis in this area. I can't know how we got there other than just the fact we've got a lot of them trying to maintain them. But are we trying now to catch these structures before they get even to a five with more simple repairs, so to speak, and less costly repairs? Because I would think if you could keep it above the five, you have less costly repair efforts to maintain it at that level, other than some areas that you're going to have to fight with erosion anyway. But
you are absolutely correct, sir, is that VDOT has a very progressive program for preventative maintenance. And preventative maintenance is to maintain structures that are in good condition, and not to let them deteriorate. I think approximately a little over 20 to 22% of the funds that are invested in the bridge program is for preventative maintenance. And then the other goes to addressing those structures at different stages below that.
One thing with that, then, when structures get to the point where they are going to have to be replaced, I know there's a couple of bridges in my area on 340, and there's one now in Front Royal that's going to be replaced. I guess when it gets to a certain point, whether it's a two or a one or whatever, you get to the point of saying this bridge is going to have to go. So then it becomes a construction issue, not a maintenance issue. Is that correct?
Those, yes, sir. Those major type structures are put in the six-year program, and I think you're talking about with the 340 over the South Fork
right
up there. That particular structure is being replaced. So.
And with that, then, what was that one rated? Is that a one now or a two?
Well, it probably had a condition rating of somewhere in three, but it was made at the turn. It's still safe. It's still turn traffic.
Yeah, and I've been going over
but they, based upon the criteria that they use for evaluation of that and the ADT, the amount of traffic it's carrying and all the significance of the structure, how they had prioritized it in the district and everything as far as a replacement, you know, that structure came up to the top of the list for this year. So
one last thing, and I would guess what might speed that process up is if the roads feeding into that bridge have changed from development or whatever to where maybe the bridge needs to be wider or structurally better because of the heavier load. Is that what you're getting at?
I mean, the functional capacity could be considered, yes, sir, in making that determination.
Okay. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Secretary. Mr. Miller,
I'm sorry.
I'd like to ask a question. In terms of public safety, I hear you. What you're saying is that some in the report, some are not in the report. Private are not in the report. As the state moves more to public-private partnerships in terms of structures and financing, are those structures, will they be in these reports?
All the public-private partnerships are required to be inspected because it is an agreement that the state has with that party, and the state still owns those structures, even though they may be operated and maintained by that private consortium.
Mr. Commissioner.
Mr. Secretary, as just a comment, Mr. Miller, you asked about the preventative maintenance, and that was kind of discussed in the last conversation. We do coordinate with the maintenance, with the bridge division and the maintenance department to dedicate a certain amount of funds each year for bridge maintenance. And the purpose of those funds there is to keep as much as possible from bridges from going from a 5 to a 4. And we have a dedicated amount to do that in the maintenance program. In addition, on the construction side, we get a recommendation of bridges that need to go into the program, a prioritized list from the bridge division to include in the six-year program, addressing those critical bridges that are like maybe at a 4 and it needs to maybe go up to a 5. And also this year in the six-year program, we made a substantial increase in bridge funding as compared to the last six-year program. I believe the amount, I don't have it on the top of my head, but it was, I want to say almost double that amount in the bridge funding in the six-year program this year. So I think we've tried to pay a lot of attention to our bridges from the funding perspective. I don't have good numbers for you yet as how much that will raise it from 92% fair condition and how much that investment will raise it forward. But we are investing substantially in this program in our bridges.
Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Holland.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Mr. Secretary and Honorable Commissioners, on behalf of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel Commission, it is quite an honor for the first time in our collective history to have this joint meeting, and we thank you and welcome you to Hampton Roads. We look forward to hosting you on a tour later today. We will remind you after our commission meeting that it's very important, given the heat, that you do dress down, business casual. I think Ms. Mathis also stated potentially could be considered rustic wear. Either way, we look forward to hosting you for the tour and then the joint reception tonight. Also appreciate the time that you're allowing to give a brief overview of the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel's infrastructure management methodology called the Modified Approach to Infrastructure Reporting. Please stop me if you have any questions. I'll look forward to answering any questions or take any comments that you have. Okay, overall, I've integrated a brief amount of history here as well. In 1956, the General Assembly enabled the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, okay, to exist separate and distinct outside of the state highway system at the time. And one of the important ingredients is that this was a full risk transfer to the bondholders, okay? The General Assembly was wise when that enablement began and that they realized that it was very important to have objective inspections done of a facility that's arguably the most unique in the world, given its oceanic location, if you will. While we say it's the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, it is very tumultuous, as you all well know, and you'll find out more a little bit later today. So it was required that we have independent inspections. At the time, the equivalency of the NBI that Mr. Napier referred to earlier in regards to the standards that were promulgated to be compliant to. Two-lane construction was completed from 1960 to 1964, and the overall baseline inspection was complete upon completion of the punch list. In 1960, 1991, 1995, new money bond issuances were executed, and the bond trust agreements were the original contract documents that were utilized as the basis for the revenue bonds. They also required objective independent inspections. 95 through 99, we had the full parallel crossing phase one completed. Essentially, the full facility, as unanimously enabled by the General Assembly, was paralleled in its entirety with the exception of parallel tunnels. One of the things that's important to denote, post-1999, that second to last bullet point, you can see that altogether, post the completion of parallel crossing phase one, we have 5,000 total piles that require the underwater inspections that Mr. Napier alluded to be compliant with the five-year frequency as required by federal highway standards, level one, level two, level three inspections. We also have two tunnels, one of which you'll tour today, four high-level bridges, 12.2 miles of trestles, 3 miles of open approach roads, four man-made islands that are 10 acres in surface area at their base at the bay bottom, 5 acres on the surface, and the perpetual easement of a four-lane highway across the National Wildlife Refuge. So quite a smorgasbord of portfolio components, and it was very important that the Commission realized that to integrate all of the variables in the context of capital planning, reporting, inspection compliance, financial statement integration, that modified approach was approved in 2004. Okay? So that begs the question, what is the modified approach? Staff would tell you it's very laborious, it's very tedious, but in fact it is a regimented protocol that fits well for an entity such as ourselves that has so much exposure in regards to the elements, okay? We tell many people, as you all well know, it's like maintaining an oil rig in the context of the facility for which we're responsible. The Commission adopted the preservation policy, as you can see at the top in blue. The current Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel Commission preservation policy to maintain 90% of the bridge and tunnel assets at a maintenance rating program condition level of generally good or better, okay? I say currently, in fact, it's on our agenda to modify that semantically to be a numeric code this afternoon during our action agenda. So the narrative code is generally good. The numeric code, as you can see on the scale, is a 7, okay? Generally good condition. Further definition, potential exists for minor maintenance, okay? So the Commission adopted the preservation policy. The scale is there that is utilized for not just the bridge and tunnel infrastructure, okay, the low-level trestles and the bridges Mr. Napier referred to earlier. We utilize the Virginia Department of Transportation as a reporting conduit after the objective independent inspections are complete by our general consulting engineer. Those B6s and B7s specifically are reported to the Bridge Inspection Division and then consolidated along with all the reporting that's made to the Federal Highway Authority. Okay, how do we stand in regards to the most recent? Our last inspections were completed over about a month of cumulative time for everything but the underwater inspections. The underwater inspections take approximately 6 months every year, given the massive amount of open water that we actually cross. The component ratings, as you can, it's tough for the audience to see, approach roads right on through site-wide utilities, all non-bridge tunnel. We'll speak to the bridge tunnel, or excuse me, the bridge, the trestles a little bit later. All of those ratings are well in compliance with the Commission's preservation policy. One thing that's interesting to denote, given that you're going to tour the tunnels, okay, you can see that the tunnels overall are rated a 7. How is that consolidated in regards to the many, many components that are found within the tunnels? If we look at our next slide, this is just the tunnel breakdown in terms of how the allocation of rating for the tunnels is deciphered from an objective inspection perspective. And then the resulting rating on each one of the specific components, okay? So you have the ventilation buildings that are broken down into the many facets A through I. Correspondingly, when we go to tunnel structure, that takes in the various components within the tunnels, many of which we'll speak to today, tunnel roadway slab walls, ceiling, lighting, supply air duct, exhaust, emergency crew walkway, portal drains and gutters, mid-channel pumps, fire emergency equipment, portal pump rooms. Okay? We actually inspect those tunnels on the same frequencies we do our fracture critical bridge at North Channel. Okay? So that gives you a breakdown, in, if you will, in regards to how the consolidation occurs. Okay, how do we stand on the trestles and the bridges? Okay? It's given, again, the 17.6 miles of open water through which we actually have the many piles that support the trestles and the bridges. Time does not allow us to consume all of that data. What I've done is I've taken a snapshot of some of the worst ratings that we have. This is just in the interest of the conservancy. This is Trestle C northbound, and this breaks down in regards to the B6, B7 allocations, deck, superstructure, substructure, channel slope protection. I want you to notice, if you will, in 2010 and 2011, the channel slope protection was rated at a 6, okay? And overall, it's very important. This commission utilizes this, getting to the point earlier that the commissioner made in regards to the BDOT in the context of a great gauge, a great tool for capital planning purposes. When we see there's degradation, when we see there's wear and tear in regards to a specific component, that is a trigger, that is a prompt, that it's time to address that specific degradation with a project that may involve minor maintenance, that may involve, in some cases, a replacement if it makes sense for the life cycle costing of that specific component to do so. Okay? In this case, the improvement was made as a result of a large-scale scour remediation project that was executed over a period of 3.5 years. We placed about 320,000 tons of stone around the areas where we had scour, okay, which is erosion of the bay bottom as opposed to what you typically think of with erosion along the shoreline. Okay, so then in terms of reporting, in terms of transparency, okay, the money that we spend on these projects from a capital plan perspective, we have a longer-term capital plan that's adopted on an annual basis. It currently goes out to 2032. What do we do with those monies that are spent? Do we simply take those monies and book those as a core capital asset addition? The answer to that is no. As you can see, here's a pie chart that depicts the revenues the facility collects. We are not subsidized. We only have revenues that are derived from tolls and lease income on real estate that we own and lease out. Okay? So from the perspective of all those allocations, if you look at the purple, any amount that we spend on preservation to maintain those core ratings that is a public policy, commission-adopted preservation policy, are booked as preservation expenses. Okay? That's what it takes to preserve the infrastructure. Okay? Overall, it also requires us that we integrate all of the core components of this modified approach from a reporting perspective, not just in our annual report. Bob Johnson will hold that up for you so you can see the detailed inspection reports he has in front of him. The summary is much more summarized. We are required to report all this in our financial statements, okay? We are audited by an objective independent auditor every year. We're required to show the budgeted preservation expenses as compared to the next slide shows the actual preservation expenses. We then are having to, even though our long-term capital plan goes out to the 2030s, we then actually take and highlight by the specific component area what we intend to allocate for a specific component. Okay, so the breakdown there shows the $10.2 million we expect to have spent when the financials were issued as of last fiscal year. Should have mentioned we're on a July 1 to June 30 fiscal year. Allocates what we expect to spend out through 2013. Okay, fiscal year 2013. And the actual summary of the ratings as far as the bridges and the trestles, percentage of land miles, at a maintenance rating program condition level of 7 or better, gives you a breakdown. 2012, we're 100%. That are maintained at 7% or better. So we're well over and beyond the requirements of the preservation policy. Correspondingly, we look at all of the other items that are non-bridge, non-trestle related, approach roads, Fisherman Island Causeway, tunnels, portal islands, toll plaza infrastructure, site-wide utilities. You can see that in the core component areas, for instance, tunnels are at 85%, okay? What is the commission doing to address that? One of the projects you'll learn about in more detail today, we just awarded our roadway repair project where we're going in, and we are actually repairing all delamination that has occurred in the incoming air plenum in regards to the structural foundation of the roadway. We then, once those repairs are done, are going to be repairing the top sides, okay? And then we are going to be going in and milling out our full wearing course and replacing it. Once that is done, we anticipate that we will be back in that 94 to 96% range. Site-wide utilities, in the same way, we have projects in which we are actually going in to do repairs, rehabilitation in regards to making sure that the infrastructure, most of which is approaching its 50-year birthday. We have our 50-year anniversary next year, April 15th of 2014. Make sure that we're able, as was relayed earlier by Mr. Napier, able to be, from a life cycle perspective, carried an extended amount of time due to proper proactive maintenance. Okay? And that completes my report. I look forward to answering any questions.
Donald, thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Holland? Excellent. Yeah, just Lane.
Jeff, just okay. Go back to your slide just quickly on the pie chart.
Sure.
I just wanted to point out to the CTB members, this afternoon we have on our agenda an issue about completing the one of the tunnels. Right now we have two-lane traffic in each direction except for two tunnels. So our project, Jeff went over the enabling legislation, is not complete. 31% of the monies, if you look on here, the future capital project funding, that is being set aside to fund that additional completion because of capacity planning models. So that's on the, I just want to point that out. That's what we'll be talking about this afternoon, about holding some information sessions to get more information as to whether or not in this economic environment we want to move that issue forward. Or not at all the above, we're discussing that. So I just wanted to point that out to you if you were might have had a question on why 31% was set aside. It's because the facility is not complete as the enabling legislation directed us to do in terms of traffic in both ways. So I just wanted to point that out. And I would invite all of you this afternoon as we're going, please participate, ask questions, and as we put up that presentation later today.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Mr. Miller.
Mr. Hall.
Yes, sir.
If you go back to your slide, I don't know which number it is. It's the one that's the modified approach infrastructure. It's like second or third, maybe.
The timeline?
Yeah.
Okay.
Right there. And you say that you adopted that in 2004, and it integrates all these variables. I presume when you go to the next slide, that those variables are irrelevant, or some of them are irrelevant as it relates to the rating program. All you're saying, the rating program is the rating program, and you certainly wouldn't consider proactive capital planning in the rating program. You might decide what to do after you got the ratings in terms of your bigger program, but I was a little bit, not confused, but I was questioning, I guess. When you said that, that has nothing necessarily to do with the rating program itself. It has to do after you get the ratings.
Okay, overall.
I mean, obviously, you know, we talked about earlier that we haven't done some things that we may have done otherwise because of money. But at the end of the day, the rating program stands alone. It's irrelevant as to how much money you have or don't have. What you end up doing after you rate something may be relevant and is relevant to public policy and money, but the rating program itself is not. Is that correct?
That is correct. The preservation policy was adopted irregardless of how much money was on hand to be able to potentially improve ratings. The ratings themselves that were evaluated was taken as a portfolio assessment of what. There's 1% of transportation entities across the United States that have adopted this approach, okay? So we actually evaluated the pros and cons of the respective preservation policies that were evident with those different entities and had been adopted. What is connected, and I think you were alluding to that yourself, is if you look at the slide that's actually on the PowerPoint currently, the results of those ratings and the resulting potential degradation, which typically will occur as you do have aging infrastructure, okay? You have components, such as the exposure we have to the scour remediation 0.4 here on the slide that's on the screen currently. When we see the degradation that has occurred, if you go back to 2006, we actually had a rating of 8. 2009, you get a rating of 7. Goes down to 2010, you have a rating of 6. So you see the actual dilution, if you will, or degradation in that rating, and that then prompts this entity in regards to evaluating where they're going to allocate the funds to make sure that they are proactively capital planning in the context, especially in our case, where the only revenue sources we have are tolls and lease income. We're not subsidized. We get no monies from Federal Highway Authority. So overall, it's very important that we utilize the funds that we have very wisely. On the other hand, if we have an area that the ratings are consistently meeting our goals and we see no anticipated degradation, at that point, it's just like you and others on the board that have your respective businesses. We're going to maximize that asset for the lifespan as long as we possibly can. So we're very sensitive in that we're not spending money that we do not have to, but at the same time, especially as relates to an area of concern such as scour, given the turbulence in which we are exposed with Bay Bottom, very important that we proactively allocate those funds in that context.
Mr.
Yes, sir.
Chairman?
Yes.
Can you please explain why the budgeted amounts year after year are so significantly higher than the actual amounts?
Yes, ma'am.
And haven't been adjusted?
Okay. One of the reasons was what I just relayed. While we, in fact, may have said, okay, when we do our long-term plan out to the 2030s, the Commission is evaluating the many variables that relate to that plan, such as you all have in the context of a six-year plan. We may allocate in 3 years that we have to take and replace a specific component in the tunnels. When we get closer to that time, we're going to continue to assess not only the rating, continue to assess the life cycle costing, and if we can preserve from spending those funds, we're certainly going to do so. So that's one component. The other component in the context of in some years where actual is less than budget is a result of the estimates that we have utilized during this time frame. Typically, we're finding that, as you all have as well, actual projects are being awarded at approximately 20 to 30% less cost than what we otherwise have estimated. That's a positive. That gets to Chairman Lane's point in the context of why we're evaluating the acceleration of the actual tunnel project. You know, the time is right from a contractual receptiveness perspective as well as an interest rate perspective to evaluate doing so. And then the other is sheer timing differences. It's not uncommon, such as the expected duration of our scour remediation project. We expected we would be in and out in 2 years. It took 3.5 years. So while you have a project in that case that came in a little bit under budget, it ended up extending out over 3.5 years. So the payments were spread over that long. So each specific fiscal year actual looks a little better than budget.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Hey, Mr. Holland, I'm sorry. Can I say this? Intriguing. Now this, your facility is 50 years old.
Yes, sir.
And
50 years old.
It was opened, and it was considered one of the 7 engineering wonders of the world and all that. I mean, are there things as you now operating it 50 years later that things that they did right? I mean, obviously the facility's there, it's doing great, but I mean, are there things now looking back on it that given the complexity of the structure, that done right, done wrong, things like that?
Yes, sir, most definitely. We, in fact, is just recently with the scoping involved in evaluating the design build delivery methodology. You know, when we look at a hybrid design build scoping that we're establishing, one of the key components is we want to look at the many things that have worked well. And the design that was completed in 60 has certainly lent itself very well to be, you know, very maintainable. There are areas where we actually realize that there are improvements that need to be made. For instance, when we egress off the trestle onto our number one island today, that specific area is extensively utilized. From a traffic engineering perspective, it's a very sensitive area. While our statistics overall in that ingress-egress area have relayed to very favorable safety results, it's potentially problematic in the future, and one of the things that we are going to massively redesign with the parallel tunnel project. One of the things that's most interesting to me about the tunnels themselves, when you look at the design in the 50s coordinated an integrated central vacuum system for the complete ventilation building, 5 stories tall. Okay? Dust is one of the major enemies, antidotes, if you will, in regards to all the electrical switchgear. It was designed with a central vacuum system. That in and of itself is a very good example of the positive engineering that's worked well over the many years.
Do we do that in ours? Do we do that in ours?
Sorry, what was it in the section?
The central vacuum system.
Oh.
That's just a Hoover.
Yes. Come on. Wayne, do we?
Mr. Chairman?
And, I'll come to you, Mr. So I'm just intrigued. Is that, and that has saved you a lot of maintenance because of the fact that.
You'll find that a core component of the electrical switchgear is the original. Essentially the mid-year life is 62, since that's the mid-year of the inception of the life. So well over 50 years old now. And we just have awarded a project whereby, such as what's, I think, being executed at HRBT, SCADA replacement project that we're in the process of. But 50 years on electrical switchgear is an excellent life. And it gets to the point that Mr. Napier answered earlier. One of the gentlemen, I believe it was Commissioner Peek, asked earlier today, what is the lifespan of a tunnel? And that's all predicated based on proactive maintenance. The first part of the multifaceted answer is proactive maintenance.
And I asked that before. I wanted to know that before they took us all down there.
Mr. Miller.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Holland, I'm kind of curious when you started asking me, you were pointing out some things that you all had done 45 years ago, Both the Hamrose Bridge Tunnel and the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel are basically the same age. A few years difference.
The original HRBT, I believe,
56.
Is... Yeah, it's about 7 or 8.
55, 56, and all were 62, 63. I don't ever remember riding the ferry to Hampton, but I do remember riding the ferry to Chesapeake. From whoever's perspective, are there big differences? I mean, obviously one's longer and has two tunnels and it's further out and it's the head of the bay, the head of the roads. Are there significant differences otherwise that are obvious to you that wouldn't be obvious to somebody like me driving across them?
Many more similarities than differences. Probably the largest difference that comes to mind is due to the elevation on the two tunnels at the CBBT, Thimble Shoal Channel Tunnel, Chesapeake Channel Tunnel. We have no necessity for floodgates. The reason for that is we're at an elevation of plus 30 as compared to HRBT, which is 16. So the elevational differences were designed as such as a result, again, of our location and the potential for tidal surge in that area being so much more vulnerable as far as the infrastructure is concerned as compared to not just HRBT but the other tunnels in the Hampton Roads area. That's probably the largest difference that I can think of.
All right, thank you.
Yes, sir?
Yeah, Ms. Lane.
Sure. Colleagues might ask, we've got a pretty aggressive maintenance schedule, and this goes sort of what Mr. Miller has said.
One of the other things is there really isn't a good alternative if we lose this facility.
Great point.
I mean, you know, now we've got four crossings in the Hampton Roads. If you monitor Merrimack Hampton Roads, you've got the James River Bridge, and you can really go around 64 over the Elizabeth, the back way to get out. But that's not the case, and that's a big difference on this facility, particularly now with Wallops Island, now an outlying landing field, and the whole amount of commerce and people traveling back and forth. So that is that's a real consideration for our board. Not that it wouldn't be on the CTB either, but there, if we were to lose this facility, in fact, today if we lose the tunnel, we've lost the facility, and that is a significant impact to the lives of people on both sides. So, Mr. Bull, that's one thing that's different. There really is no alternative.
Yeah, I was going to the design.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Chairman. Yes, Mr. Ellison.
Mr. Holland, good presentation. One of the things I want to ask is that I know on the Hampton Roads and even Monitor Merrimack tunnels, you know, some of the electrical components and some of the things aren't even manufactured anymore, you know, because of the age of the equipment and everything. Do you have a plan for assessing that, or as far as how you would replace those various components? I'm sure, you know, you all have the same issues, you know, given that the tunnels were constructed about the same time.
Yes, sir. When we actually look at our long-term capital plan, we look at the critical components to see if there's going to be a concern for the potential of not having that replaceable piece of equipment. Overall, as much as we try to proactively do that, there are times such as when we had our tunnel retrofit on the walls and the ceiling. We could not find the actual tile that we specified anywhere in the United States. We had to suspend the procurement, and we actually had to have that tile developed through a separate procured contract for just the materials in Germany. And we were unable to commence that project until that tile was in place, ready to be utilized. So as much as we try to proactively plan, we find kinks in the armor, I'll readily tell you.
Okay, because I know it's an issue, you just can't run out to...
Yes, sir.
Global Walmart. Vendor, yeah, Walmart or, you know, supply house.
Home Depot is where we normally go.
That's right, those components anymore.
Yes, sir.
Right.
Any other questions? Thank you, sir. Appreciate
Thank
it.
Thank you.
Listen,
appreciate the opportunity.
I know this is kind of a shock to the CTB members, but we're behind schedule. Yes.
No, it's not you. Mr. Miller's been quiet today, so I can't blame you, Mr. Miller. It's actually, can we ask, why don't we go ahead and break for just 10 minutes? Everyone can grab their lunches, and then we'll go right into the next presentation. 12:30. 12:30, if we could grab lunches, eat at our desks, and we'll start off at 12:30.
San Diego this morning. We landed in Richmond at 9:20 and rented a car and drove over there.
You didn't fly here?
I didn't even look to see if there was a flight to Norfolk because I should have traveled.
When I came back, the day that I got back, it was good. I was sitting in my office. I didn't even know it until the phone rang again. I couldn't even remember what I was doing.
That's what I'm going to do.
Okay, can we ask, I'm sorry, I understand that the commission actually has to start exactly at 1 o'clock, so we're going to try to limit any sort of Q&As on the next couple of presentations to the very end to make sure that we get everything done. So, Perry, you leading us off?
Good afternoon. My name is Perry Cogburn. I'm here from VDOT, and I work for Field Operations in the Operations Division. We're going to do a tag team presentation today. Our presentation will involve Stuart Baker from Virginia Department of Emergency Management, then Captain Danny Plott from the Virginia State Police, and I'll finish up. So with no further ado, I'll give it over to Stuart.
Thank you, Perry. The hurricane and tropical storm specific hazard annexed to the Virginia Emergency Operations Plan is a section that I am responsible for maintaining in cooperation with multiple state agencies. The evacuation premise in that plan, since our largest threat to the Commonwealth is that from a hurricane, is to only evacuate persons from the potentially storm surge impacted areas, those that may reside in mobile homes or other substandard structures. We do try through our outreach program to certainly advise the citizens of the Commonwealth and visitors to be prepared to be on their own for at least 3 days without any outside support while available resources are ready, and we do maintain a hurricane awareness program through various avenues to get that point across. Just to give you some perspective on the folks subject to storm surge inundation, this is just a partial map of the coastal area of the Commonwealth that shows the maximum inundation zones up to and including a Category 4 hurricane. You may question, why do we not show a Category 5? From all the studies that we have completed and in multiple consultations with the National Hurricane Center and the folks at the National Weather Service, the likelihood of a Category 5 in this high latitude is minuscule. So we look at Category 4 as the maximum storm surge index that we would anticipate. So it does cover a significant portion of our geographic area. And it does, in addition, go further north than Matthews County, as shown on this particular graphic. For our Category 4, our basic planning premises on which our plan is based is that these are the specifics that we have to plan for. Out of a total of approximately 1.6 million people in the immediate Hampton Roads area, 1.2 million people could potentially be subject to storm surge inundation. That could be anywhere from 1 inch to 20 feet of water in specific areas or more. Approximately 75% of the population would potentially be impacted. Of that population, we have determined that approximately 400,000 vehicles would be projected to leave Hampton Roads and seek refuge in inland parts of the state or other locations. That would equate to approximately 900,000 people leaving Hampton Roads. Bear in mind, if we have 900,000 leaving, we still have 700,000 people still in Hampton Roads that are going to shelter in place and bear the brunt of the storm. How long does it take to move these people to points of safety for a Category 4? Our basic projections and through the multiple studies that have been done indicate that it would take 61 hours or more without any traffic accidents, which we know will occur, to move that total number of people. This information is what prompted us many years ago to start the development of a hurricane lane reversal plan. As many of you know, we do have that plan in place for I-64, but it's only targeted to a specific population of the Hampton Roads population. But of that 61 hours, that evacuation time for that segment of the population can be reduced to 38 hours. This is prior to the arrival of sustained tropical storm force winds. On the graphic before you, the red triangle, which encompasses the northern portion of Virginia Beach and all of the city of Norfolk, they are the targeted population that would utilize the reverse lanes of I-64. However, that time reduction for I-64 is not our determining factor for when to implement an evacuation. The remainder of the population, as you see with the red oval, has to go toward the southwest out through Bowers Hill, which is a very congested area, to exit out of the state or to the interior part of the state to on routes 460 or 58. There is no option there to reduce that time from 61 hours for a Cat 4 at this particular time. This also needs to be noted on this graphic as well that the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel, Route 13 going north, is not one of the designated evacuation routes. You may ask why. A couple of reasons for that. The primary reason is that due to its geographic location, that is one of the very first facilities that would potentially be impacted by any storm conditions, thereby implementing their established restrictions and or potential closure to cease the flow of traffic. It doesn't mean people won't use it to evacuate. The people that will use it will leave considerably earlier prior to being told to evacuate. The second reason for that is that folks that would evacuate north on Route 13 up the eastern shore would be going into an area where there is very limited shelter capacity if they did need that to utilize those facilities in case they were late in making their decision and the storm speeded its forward motion or its wind fields expanded, impacting that area. This is a comparison from the many studies that we have of the evacuation clearance times for the people at risk to get to points of safety for the various category storms. You notice we have an arrow by category 3. The hurricane plan in the COVOC, the timeline in that plan, which is shown later in this presentation, is based on a category 3 as being our most likely catastrophic impact event based upon our hurricane history here in the Commonwealth. Without lane reversal, the general time to evacuate all the people in Hampton Roads would be between 36 and 38 hours. With the implementation of the lane reversal option for the designated segment of the population, which I previously identified, that time would be reduced to 22 hours, which is a savings of 16 hours. However, as previously stated, the Bowers Hill timeline is our determining factor in making the call to implement evacuation in concert with the localities. The evacuation timeline for a Cat 3, this is quite a detailed graphic. It includes a lot of activities on here that are specifically established according to readiness conditions in the state plan. We do anticipate for a Category 3 event, we would request a declaration from the governor's office for a state of emergency, which initiates a lot of activities within the state agencies. We would have a hurricane watch issued at 48 hours by the National Weather Service at the same time that the governor would have a coordinated conference call with the chief elected officials in each of the risk localities so he can share with them his thoughts based upon the threat of what he's considering or potentially considering about the implementation of lane reversals, whether to do it or not. A hurricane warning would be implemented at 36 hours. However, as previously shown, the folks at minimum at the south side would have to start moving at 38 hours for a Category 3 threat in order for everyone wanting to evacuate to have time to get to a point of safety. At this time, unless there's any questions, I'll turn it over to Captain Plott with the Virginia State Police.
Good afternoon. My name is Danny Plott. I'm the Division Commander of 5th Division, which encompasses most of the southeast portion of Virginia. I have to smile when I first got here this morning. I think I made a few of you uneasy because you perhaps thought I was here for something other than being a speaker. I'm not, but I would like to point out that I have kept the distinguished but sometimes unruly folks behind me calm during this meeting. The hurricane evacuation, ladies and gentlemen, is almost a ballet. It's all based on time, which Stuart brought up to you. It's also based on several things. As far as the Department of State Police, and I bring you greetings from Colonel Steve Flaherty, who would have been here if he could have been, we will bring in approximately 250 troopers, maybe a few more, maybe a few less, to man these gates and so forth on this lane reversal. What we plan to do on the 21st of July is do a small exercise where we will close designated gates and put troopers there. We'll set up our communications, which those of you that have been involved, especially in the military or any type of logistics, usually the first thing that goes wrong in something like this is communications. If you have communications, then chances are things will go well. We'll have our mobile command post set up at 295 and 64, which basically ends the hurricane evacuation route. As you saw from Mr. Baker's charts, those that choose to go from the Hampton Roads area are going to be taken up there, and then hopefully, you know, they'll be away from the storm and things like that. Very often, and I forget, Stuart, maybe you can tell me, the last time we did an exercise was 2008, we exercised. And basically what we do is we lower the gates. Those of you, well, probably every one of you came down here driving, you'll often see the red and white gates. Top of the ramps, below the ramps, they'll be lowered. And it's very simple, and I'm sure you all know, that if we turn the lanes, the eastbound lanes into Hampton Roads will go westbound. So we will take, I believe, four different exits on the 21st, on the very early morning hours of the 21st, to cut down on traffic problems. We'll lower the gates. We'll check our communications. And if this happens, as Stuart told you, a lot of it depends on timing. If you pay attention to that time graph, that's the timing that's the most important. And before, once tropical storm force winds arrive, we will also pull everybody off the interstate and we will return the lanes to what they're supposed to be. But before we do that, we will check and make sure there's nobody in the wrong lane and so on and so forth. The best way to describe it, ladies and gentlemen, is an organized ballet. We have to make sure that everybody's okay. We have to make sure the lanes have been returned. And what we'll do on the early morning hours of the 21st is we're going to practice that. I'll be glad to entertain any questions, and I thank you for the opportunity to speak to you. Thank you.
You don't want to become an adult.
Thank you, Stuart, and thank you, Captain Plott. VDOT's role in hurricane evacuation is to provide staffing basically for for the hurricane gate. VDOT will have staff at every ramp. We report traffic conditions back to the TOC so information can get on to 511. And during the exercise on July 21st, which is this Sunday morning, even though the exercise is only for 205, mile marker 205 to 231, VDOT will have staff at every ramp just so that we can introduce the people, make sure they're where we're supposed to be, how it's going to work, but only the gates on from 205 to 231 will be closed. VDOT's our other role on this is we provide fuel and towing services. When the gates go down and we start to do a sweep, we have towers that will go down, assist pulling vehicles off the road, and we have towers staged at various ramps along the interstate so that if something breaks down, we can get out there, get them quick, because the worst thing that can happen is we can get a lane blockage during a lane reversal. We also provide backup communications. VDOT has its own legacy system that we can use backup communications to the state police stars. And also, we pre-deploy folks from around the state into the Hampton Roads area. We did that during Irene, and we've done it during other storms that have threatened us. And as a process, then we have people there when we need them. This is just a graphic of the lane reversal. The people on the peninsula have free and clear use of all entry and exit ramps. The people on the south side were the ones who would go over to the reversal lanes, who will be traveling westbound and eastbound lanes. The first time they can get off is at Lightfoot, exit 234. The second time they can get off is at 205, which is Bottoms Bridge, and the lane reversal ends at 200. Along the way, because there are only two places for them to get off, we will potentially provide fuel at Jefferson Avenue, CD Road, 255, and at the New Kent Rest Area. Now, I've got the other graphic, which is the bottom graphic, 295. That's probably the most complicated ramp closures we have. As you can see, there's a lot of things going on there. And that's also where the incident command post is located. Again, this is just a quick view of the number of personnel required to do this lane reversal. Again, this is each ramp that's going to have people there. VDOT, VSP, and National Guard will get each one of these ramps. And again, the bottom number here is that to do a lane reversal, that's 348 personnel per 12-hour shift. Now, you're looking at a 36-hour timeline, so that's at least a minimum of three shifts to do the lane reversal. Facility closure plans. Now, we do have facility closure plans for all our facilities in the Hampton Roads area. The plans currently are based on the arrival of 45-mile-per-hour winds. We have, over the last few years, been looking at the tides, and hopefully with this year, we don't have any hurricanes to impact us, but we're looking at changing the winds to the tide levels. Closures will be determined by district management in association with chief engineer or central office, so that we'll make sure that everybody's aware that there's a closure taking place, and localities. One of the big things, we let VDEM know, we let the localities know when and if we're going to close the facility. And those facilities with floodgates may take a little longer to take care of, because what happens is you have that open cut, and the water builds up in an open cut, then we have to dewater that cut. Now, Stuart's already referred to the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel. It's not a designated state evacuation route. It doesn't mean the people aren't going to use it. It's just not a designated evacuation route, because one of the things, a large portion of the facility is exposed to winds. With that, any questions for Captain Plott, Stuart, or myself?
Okay, we're going to... Listen, what we're going to do, by the way, because, again, the commission has to start at 1 o'clock. We'll have the last presentation. Ms. Drake and Ms. Arbeck are okay tomorrow morning before we do our actual meeting. So we can go ahead and entertain some questions. Jeff, why don't you come up to yours, and then we'll do it all away. Where were you exactly?
Yeah, I believe it's... Where exactly? Thank you. Once again, thank you for the opportunity to give you a brief overview of the CBVT. In the context this time of the Emergency Action Plan, our Chief of Police, Eddie Spencer,
has the full emergency action plan. If anyone would like to see that, and if you have any questions, any comments in that context, please see him after this portion of the meeting. As was alluded to earlier, from the regular wind restrictions perspective, we do have regimented wind restrictions, again, as a result of our location. On average, annually, we have 40 weather restrictions per year. Okay? Again, that's 40 weather restrictions per year. It is regimented based on sustained miles per hour. You have the actual weather restriction policy before you. In the context of not being in a named storm type of environment, named storm type of situation, okay? We have 6 weather monitoring stations across the facility. Given our elongated length, it is necessary, especially as results in the types of cells that spawn in the bay, primarily late spring, summer, early fall. We could have sustained winds in excess of 60 miles an hour in the north end of the facility. The most southern end, the portion that you'll be entering through as we proceed for our tour today, South Plaza, maybe 5 to 10. So quite a difference in the context of the facility as regards to the impact of restrictions. You can see that we have level 1, level 2. Once we get to level 4, all traffic is actually restricted with the exception of cars without exterior cargo, pickup trucks without cargo, minivans, SUVs. One of the things the operations department logistically manages is we have an actual escort service that's able to provide enclosed, elongated vans that are able to travel up to 55 miles per hour to take that exterior cargo. It is a service that is extremely applauded by the customers in the context, not having to be restricted for sake of just having a luggage rack that has a car top carrier on it. We actually will remove that, assist them in putting that in the elongated van so that they are able to proceed with their vehicle that otherwise is unable to cross during the restrictions. Okay? We get to level 5 to where we just have cars without exterior cargo and then close all traffic at 70 miles per hour. Okay? I mentioned that we have 6 weather monitoring stations across the facility. How does this traffic beveled weather restriction policy get impacted in light of a named storm? What we do is, if it in fact is a named storm, okay, we actually utilize all of the meetings of exchange that we possibly can to make sure that the public is well aware, as Mr. Baker alluded to earlier, that if it is a named storm that is expected to generate winds, in this case, that will probably spur closure on this facility, we make sure through the various mediums of exchange that folks are well aware that it in fact is going to be more aggressively restricted than typical. You may ask in that context, what are those mediums of exchange? We have our variable message signage prior to the facility. We are integrated with the state's 511 system in the context of being able to provide the alerts as relates to weather, not just wind restrictions. Our own website, 1680 AM Advisory. We have Twitter, in which we utilize now to proactively get the word out to the traveling public that actually follow Twitter, text via fast follow, as well as a synchronized trunk system that can accommodate up to 23 callers at once that are calling to see exactly what will be the expected timeline of the beveled closures. We work very closely with Wakefield and the National Weather Service, as you can imagine, in regards to making sure that we are conservative in regards to implementation. And also, as Mr. Baker relayed, due to the sensitivity of the local populations, we are not an evacuation corridor, okay, that is named. All right. The last thing, as you know well, that we want to do is have those individuals that live south side, south of the facility, that are trying to evacuate north, get on the Delmarva Peninsula, and not able to get off in light of an impending storm. Likewise, for folks that live on the Delmarva Peninsula, the last thing that you and we would want to see is the volumes of people added on to the other volumes that are trying to be attended to in regards to getting them out of the Hampton Roads area. So Route 1, Route 13, Route 113 North are considered evacuation for Delmarva residents, Delmarva Peninsula residents, that is, as well as the Route 50 West in the context of depending upon what the storm direction is and specific to that new storm. Okay, so we actually have the more aggressive regimentation of our weather restriction policy. And from a facility perspective, the facility is designed and built to withstand 100 mile an hour wind load rating, okay? All vertical structures on the man-made islands are built to withstand 120 mile an hour wind load rating. So in the context of the storm, one of the things that we would do additionally over and beyond battening down the hatches, quote unquote, is to actually take the storms anticipated to have a good amount of tidal surge to the extent that it would potentially take and throw the chinking stone around the man-made islands into the cuts, drain those smaller chinking stone down to the interceptor grates, which you all will see during your tour today. We actually have sandbags that we will deploy to serve as a filtering system so that the actual interceptor grates are able to pump the water. We have capacity to pump 7,300 gallons per minute in each of the tunnels. We've talked about the fact that we do not have floodgates in the previous presentation, and we actually want to preempt those interceptor grates, which are the main sump areas in which that drainage would flow from being chinked up, if you will, with chinking stone from the armoring stone, from armoring rocks. After the facility is cleared of the weather in the context of hurricane, we actually have the damage survey team that is in fact deployed to assess the full facility before we actually begin the reopening of the facility. We also, it's important to denote, maintain very close coordination with our risk management partners. We do not self-insure. We actually have a catastrophic policy that we actually have currently placed with Lloyd's of London. Provides a $225 million limit per occurrence, and it's not aggregated at a maximum aggregate per annum. So it's important to denote if we were to have the named storms back-to-back in August, in late July, we do have coverage for those types of events. Tornadoes. One of the things that we have in our emergency action plan, I just wanted to touch on it real quick, in the context of those tornadoes that spawn suddenly, given our length, it's very concerning in regards to what happens with traffic that's on the facility. One of the things that we utilize in that context is those tunnels to be able to take and as much as we possibly can store the traveling public in their respective vehicles, if you will, until that imminent threat passes over the facility. So we try to get those folks off of the facility into those tubes where they're going to be the safest in that context. Okay. Anyone have any questions, any comments?
Okay, we got 3 minutes for questions. Does anybody have any questions?
Yes. I'm not sure if you can answer this. The plans reflect around automobiles transportation because it is VDOT. But what about mass transportation for those that do not own a car? Are you taking into consideration the buses or maybe even the train to move the population out because the roads will be full? And so I was wondering, have we looked at the other mass transportation that we have to alleviate some of the jams?
I know each city has their own emergency management.
Couldn't really hear you well back there, but is your question dealing with a mass evacuation?
Right. Are you using the train or other mass transportation systems?
Emergency management in conjunction with Department of Rail and Public Transportation several years ago embarked upon an investigation of talking to the various railroad operators within the state. And there were multiple issues that we ran up against about the way that they secure their tracks during an impending impact, and how, and there's different widths of track, and the need to move in sufficient personnel cars, carrying cars, if you will, passenger cars. And between them moving their resources out, because we're not passenger based yet, we're working toward that, but we would have to bring in passenger capabilities to be able to do it. Then you run into the issue, where are you going to go with those? What are going to be the direct lines? For the short term, it's something that was undoable as far as being able to address that. What we did opt for in view of that is looking at, as a lesson learned from other major storms in the country, how do you move the transportation-dependent population? As such, instead of looking at trains, the state has a bus contract that it can implement, and we are working with the individual localities now to determine that portion of the population that would need to evacuate that does not have any transportation means. And they would convey that information to the state EOC once the bus even before the bus contract is implemented, said, I have X number of people to move to a state-managed shelter or somewhere inland in the state, and we would allocate through the state contract the necessary number of buses to that jurisdiction to move that population.
We have 30 seconds.
Mr. Chairman.
Ms. Miller.
In the, I know it's not an evacuation route. It's more of a hypothetical question. In the case of an emergency, does the governor have control of that bridge tunnel?
Yes.
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 I would think so. Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Well, listen, again, I appreciate very much the presentation. The last presentation we'll do tomorrow right before the action meeting. And appreciate those who are here today. And with that, it's exactly 1 o'clock, and I'm going to turn the gavel over to Chairman Lane. Do you want to use my gavel?
I got
you
one
have your own gavel.
I got
his own gavel.
That's right. So
my gavel's bigger than your
gavel.
You're
a much bigger gavel.
Well, thank you.
You have money.
I'll see you on the back.